on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
It's John Dean Cox again, this time he's in! At the second time of asking, Dean Cox takes Leighton Orient a step closer to Wembley.
Carroll. Jonathan Tahoué. Capable of anything, Tahoué! Equaliser for Leighton Orient!
We're not a city, we're not a town. We're the only one of us around, and you know where we can be found. When Saturday comes again, we'll be trying to do our best to cheer all those on who wear the vest. Whatever challenge, whatever test, we're Leighton Orient from E10. Leighton Orient from E10.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome along to another edition of the Orient Hour. I'm Andy Gilson in the Brentwood studios of Phoenix 98 FM. And opposite me, we have Gareth. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Andy. How are you, mate?
Very well. And to my right, a legend, Terry Howard.
Good evening, everyone.
Thank you, Terry, for those kind words. And our guest tonight, of course, a little later on, is Richie Wellens, the Orient boss, who was talking to Alex Stripe and to Grant Conway yesterday afternoon. We've got that coming up later on for you. No games, of course, last week, so nothing to discuss football-wise from that. We'll be looking forward, of course, to the Easter weekend fixtures later on with the lads, and we'll be chewing the fat over the Wellens interview as well. But some sad news this week, of course, which overshadowed a lot of the club. Yet another member of the semi-final squad has passed away, and Peter Bennett, who was with the club throughout the 1970s. And we asked our friend and our colleague, Mr. Tongue, Steve Tongue, former chief sports writer for the Independent newspaper, for football, I should say, the football writer, chief sports football writer, to do a little tribute, if he could. And he said, certainly. And here it is, Steve's tribute to Peter Bennett.
With no disrespect whatsoever, it's fair to say that Orient supporters weren't particularly excited by the news early in the 1970-71 season that Peter Bennett, known to everyone in football as Les after an old Spurs and West Ham player, was moving from Upton Park to Brisbane Road. The reason was that the much-loved and admired Tommy Taylor, only 19 years old, was going the other way. For many of us, that was just the latest, and we knew by no means the last, of talented young O's players who would inevitably move on to bigger things. Even those supporters who would happily watch the O's one week and West Ham the next, as many did in those days, probably didn't know all that much about the slightly older Bennett. He was very much a squad player at the bowl-in, who, in the days of only one substitute, had made fewer than 50 appearances in 7 years. But if it was playing time he wanted, he certainly got it at our place. From the day of his debut in October, he played in every game, League and Cup, for the rest of the season. And alongside that classic old centre-half, Terry Mancini, he was the perfect ball-playing partner in the centre of defence. George Petchy, who took over when Jimmy Bloomfield went to Leicester at the end of that season, clearly admired Les just as much, soon made him captain, and was perfectly happy to move him into midfield when required, where his reading of the game, his passing ability, his effectiveness in the tackle, all made him more than useful. But it was at the back that he excelled in that exciting 1972 FA Cup run against top quality opposition like Leicester, Chelsea and Arsenal. 2 years later, he suffered the worst injury of his career, a pelvic one, and was out for 12 months. And what a miss he was in that season that ended so agonisingly, 1 point, just one goal short of promotion back to the top division. But Les still had four more seasons in him, the most memorable of them being the last one in 1977-78, which will always be known as Cup semi-final year. 6 years earlier, he'd been in the team knocked out in the quarter-final by Arsenal, and now he was facing them in the last four at Stamford Bridge. No happy ending, of course, and there'd be only half a dozen games at the start of the following season before another injury caused his premature retirement, aged only 32. There should have been far more games than his 200 from a real 100%er who gave everything for the club and often paid the price. As well as that whole year's absence, there was a broken collarbone and a broken leg too. All, don't forget, in the last period when we were a force in the second division of English football. Peter, Les, thanks for everything.
And thank you very much, Steve Tung, for that tribute, and rest in peace, Peter. Very sad news indeed. Anyway, what we got next? This week's Victor's View.
I was so sorry to hear of the passing of Peter Bennett. I consider myself fortunate to have seen that special Orient side of the 70s. As a supporter, you knew just how much Peter loved playing the game. His passion, versatility, was coupled with determination, skill and grace. They were exceptional and the mark of the man. Our thoughts are with Peter's family and friends. Last summer, when I prepared the pre-season prediction for the BBC website, I said that I thought a top 10 finish with a push for the playoffs was a realistic target for the League Two champions. What I didn't foresee was a dreadful series of injuries to key players that would prevent Richie Wellens from being able to field his strongest starting 11 at any stage of the campaign. So for the O's to be heading into the Easter programme 10th, still in the chase for the playoffs, is in itself a significant achievement. Only three games were played in League One during last weekend's international break, and they demonstrated just how open and competitive the division is. Derby County slipping up at Northampton. Stevenage needed a 96th minute equaliser to take a point back from bottom of the table Carlisle. That leaves the O's 4 points behind Bower. Both now have 7 games remaining. Oxford currently occupying that all-important 6th place, 5 points ahead of the O's, 2 points ahead of Lincoln. 5 clubs chasing that final playoff position. Goal difference could be such an important factor. That definitely places the O's at a disadvantage. Lincoln have an impressive and important positive 23-goal difference, having scored an astonishing 16 in the last 3 games. Blackpool, plus 13, Stevenage plus 11, one fewer than Oxford. The O's goal difference currently 0. It is, of course, going to be a testing and exciting Easter programme. Peterborough coming up on Easter Monday. Darren Ferguson's team currently 4th, having won 5 of the last 6 league matches. But first, we travel to inform Lincoln on Good Friday. It will, of course, be the 3rd occasion the clubs have met this season. So much has changed since that tragic night at Brisbane Road back in early October. Mark Kennedy became the first Lincoln manager to be sacked in 9 years. The reason given? Not just about results, although 1 win in 6, disappointing for a club looking to improve on last season's top half finish. Kennedy's criticism of individual players has also seemed to be a factor. City did not act immediately to appoint a replacement. They waited before surprising many with Michael Scubara, the 41-year-old's first senior permanent manager's position, and his route to the top, unusual to say the least. A former PE teacher, he played non-league whilst coaching part-time youngsters at Coventry and Nottingham Forest before moving to Thailand to play futsal, before going on to coach the national side. It's a football-based sport that's played on a smaller, hard court, and that ensures it's faster as well as more intense than traditional soccer. Skubala has been successful in transferring the qualities of the game to football, coaching England's under-18s and then Leeds United's under-21s. He got off to a winning start at Lincoln, victory at Stevenage, followed with a midweek win at Brisbane Road. The impact of his hybrid approach has continued. City are top of the form league, winning 8 of their last 10. You have to go back to New Year's Day. Blackpool, the last side to take maximum points from the Imps, who have won 5 of the last 6 at home. Bolton, the last team to win at Cintl Bank, and that was on Boxing Day. Whatever the outcome on Good Friday, The meeting of the imps and the o's will have a particular significance, and our thoughts will be with the family and friends of Derek Reynolds.
Thanks very much, Dave Victor, for this week's Victor's View. And we're talking about the fixtures coming up. And Terry, you were just saying off mic, a very, very tough Easter period and very, very strong opposition.
Yeah, I mean, it would appear that since we played Lincoln in that replayed game, I don't know how much change of personnel they've had or whatever, but it would appear they're a different team at the moment. They're the form team of the division. They're scoring goals for fun, not letting many in. That will be a very, very tough trip on Friday.
Yeah, and you've got Peterborough coming up as well, Gareth.
Yeah, another tough tie, isn't it? I think both of them are really, really challenging games. And if we could get out those with 2 points, I think we're doing well, aren't we? You know. So.
Well, we did this the other week and last week, and I asked everybody for their predictions of the scores. Terry, would you like to give us yours?
Well, I would say, kind of agreeing with Gareth, that if we could nick a win out of the two of them or two draws, I'd look upon that as not a bad Easter in terms of, as I say, because we're playing like the team that's in the playoffs and been good all season, and the other team that, as I say, probably, I haven't looked at the stats, but I've got to be in the top three form teams in the division.
So, come on, scores.
I think that we, if I'm being totally honest, like with my head and not my heart, I think we'll struggle at Lincoln. Maybe a narrow defeat. I think we can get something out of the Peterborough game.
And Gareth?
I'd say the same. I think we're quite resilient away from home, so I'd be hopeful that we could perhaps stop Lincoln, but that's easier said than done, isn't it? So I think a 1-1 would be fantastic up there. And I do think we might get something against Peterborough. I thought we were impressive against them very early in the season at their place. I mean, obviously they're a good side with some good players, and they play a very expansive style of football, don't they? But yeah, I just have this inkling we might nick that 1-1-0 at home, so that would be the 4 points rather than the two.
In all honesty, we've done better against the better sides lately, yeah. Which that augurs well for us. We seem to up our game. It got mentioned, I think, upcoming in one of the questions in Richie's interview, that where teams, the better teams, will come out and play a little bit, it does help us. We struggle to break down teams who sit deep. So from that aspect, Lincoln and Peterborough, you would expect that they'll come at us, so it will leave some gaps for us to hopefully exploit.
Okay, fine. Well, talking about Richie, I'll tell you what we'll do. We will have the Richie Wellens interview. Now, I need to explain to you folks that we had to do this via Zoom, and it's not my favourite method, but Alex Stripe and Grant Conway undertook the interview on behalf of us, and Richie was on a car phone, and a mobile at the time, so that's one obstacle, and Grant had, I don't know what was going on there, but from his end there was a bit of interference, but we got there in the end, and it's come out. But to do expect some delay on the signal at times and a little bit of interference, which we apologize for in advance, but with Zoom I'm afraid you're in the lap of the gods sometimes. But here's the Richie Wellens interview then.
To some extent, I prefer other people to speak about my stance, but I think I'm quite lucky in terms of the age that I'm at. So I understand the older players, the likes of Pratt, Beckles, but I also have a young son who's making his way in the game at 21, so I understand the younger ones as well. So I think in terms of the players feeling comfortable around there, I make them feel comfortable. Obviously, they need to be aligned, a respect, and where, you know, they need to be disciplined and respect. But also, I do like a laugh and a joke with the players, and I like them to work in an environment where they can work freely. I think tactically I'm good. And I think of the experience that I've built up, I think I'm nearly at 300 games now, so the experiences that I've built up have helped me, whereas in my younger days it was just about players, it was just about tactics, whereas now understanding the people in training ground, not just the players, not just making sure everybody's happy at the club, working upwards from Martin Ling to Nigel Travis, but making sure that the whole lines of communication through the club are running smoothly, and I think you only get that with experience.
Lovely.
Okay, Richard, we've got a number of questions. Sometimes they may be half an opinion, just to put a caveat there. They're not necessarily our opinion as such. They've come from left, right and centre. So take any offence from some of the stuff that we ask you, which we may not ask ourselves. I've got a question here. At the beginning of the season, could you please tell us what your expectations and targets were for the season, and how do you think that's panning out?
What the club's expectations or my expectations?
Yours, actually, please.
I looked at the league and I thought that Reading have got point deductions, Wigan have got point deductions, Blackpool have been relegated from the Championship and lost the best player in Gerry Yates. I think there was a number of clubs that had a little bit of uncertainty about them. I think if you go back to my interviews at the start of the season, I did say that one or two teams that unexpected will finish in and around the playoff. I think Inos and Stevenage and obviously Lincoln have given a little bit of a surge at the moment. I think that one of them teams potentially could get in. So my expectations would have been around, you know, I do think that the top five, the budgets that they have are so big that the squad depth just mean that when they pick up injuries, they can still keep the same levels. Well, I think below that, it's really tough for us. So if you'd have said to me I'd finish between 6th and 10th, then I would have probably been not happy with it, but I probably would have settled for it. In terms of the club's ambitions, we wanted to know roughly where we was in the budget, and we split the league into three groups of eight, and we believed that we was in the bottom eight of the second group. So 16th was our target as a club, and after the first four games I probably would have took 16th, but you know, we've recovered really well, and I think at times shown we've been one of the better teams in the league. So it's still an opportunity at that sixth spot, so let's keep trying for it.
Very well said. Kind of mentioned there, like, we've seen glimpses of us looking like the best team, like one of the best teams in the league, and you mentioned recently you've not even had the chance to pick your strongest 11. Would you say there was a stretch of games or a game where you've been the closest to picking your strongest team, or not at all?
Well, supporters always ask this question, or they have a go at a manager, or they say certain, like, just lazy comments, like, oh, the manager doesn't know his starting 11, his best 11. Well, the only way that you can know your best 11 is if you've put what you think is your best 11 out, and you have an injury for your squad, and you have a run of games with that 11. So we've never had a run of games where Jordan Graham has been fit with Dan Aggett, Max Sanders, Theo Archer, but we've had so many injuries, Dan Happ, that the nearest we've had to our strongest 11 would have been in and around the January period when that fantastic run. But we also haven't got Jordan Graham fit, who I believe is one of the best wingers in the league. So I don't think I've ever had my best 11 fit. I don't think that I've ever had, forget my best 11, I've never had everybody in the squad fit where you can get to 70 minutes and I turn round and I have the likes of Jordan Graham, Dan Aggie, Theo Archibald on the bench, and I can really impact the last 20 minutes of the game. You look at the likes of Burton at home, Bristol Rovers at home, Port Vale recently, the 0-0. You know, we started the game okay, and the games, but that's when you win the games. The likes of Portsmouth, the likes of Bolton, the likes of Derby will come a lot of the times win that game in the last 20 minutes when the bench comes on and finishes the game off, and we've definitely never had that.
Interesting, yeah.
Richie, there's been a little bit of talk about this, and some of it's been public knowledge, that we were in for a senior striker in the January window that unfortunately never came off. And there was a strong, I don't know how far you're able to elaborate on that, but there was a strong rumour that it was someone that was with us last season. I don't know whether you're able to comment any further at this stage about that now that it's all that
ships
failed.
Yeah, no, I mean, on a deadline day, we was a player that we've never had before, and I just think it's irresponsible of me to speak about a player that is at another club and potentially we could go back for in the summer. So I think it's better that we keep that anonymous here.
I understand. It's just that I was asked to put the question, so I've done it. Yeah, but thank you.
Lovely. This is a personal one for myself. Is there a tactical reason why Cooper and Beckles play on their opposite foot? As so, for example, you probably are aware, I believe Omar Beckles is naturally left-footed, Cooper's naturally right-footed, but they usually play vice versa. Is that like a tactical decision, or... Yeah, I'm just wondering whether...
How long have you been watching Omar Beckles?
Since he signed in 2021.
And you think Omar Beckles is left-footed?
To be fair, I was going off of stats, but no, I think I'd actually argue he's both-footed.
Omar Beckles is 90% right-footed.
Yeah.
Brandon Cooper is 90% right-footed. Ed Turns was 90% right-footed. So unless we have Dan Hap, then we're always going to have to play two right-footed centre-backs at centre-back. So one of them has to play on the left. Ed Turns really enjoys playing the left. And Brandon Cooper really enjoys playing the left. So it opens the game up for them as they step in. But yeah, there's no tactical reason. Omar Beckwell is right-footed. So when we have to pick two right-footed centre-backs, we want the players that is playing on their wrong side to be comfortable. And we've been lucky with Ed Turns and Brandon Cooper are happy to do that.
Gotcha. No. Thank you very much for asking that, because I've been wondering about that for a while. But yeah, thank you for correcting me.
No problem.
Just arising from that answer, actually, this is a little bit of an elephant in the room with regards to we were left a little bit perhaps thin in the squad in that area as a result of the transfer window, and it was such a shame that we lost Ed Turns. I expect you're really disappointed about that. And as I say, you're down to the bare bones as far as having players in competition for places.
Well, that was the reason we brought Jack Simpson, and we think that Jack will be a good player for us, not just for this season but the next season as well. So right. he's not far from being included in the squad. Ed Turns was obviously not getting as much game time as he wanted, but he would have been I had no qualms about ever putting Eddie in the team, but he wanted to play week in, week out, and an opportunity for him to play at Crewe presented himself. But I didn't want to let him go until we got the striker in. It's just that sometimes you leave it too late on deadline day, things can get messy, and from our side it probably did get a little bit too messy, which is not ideal.
Thank you for that, Richie. But we understand.
But I have to say, there's no elephant in the room. This is just about us being honest with each other, being honest about our processes, and how do we make sure that we don't make the same mistakes going forward, and we'll make sure that we're on the ball a little bit quicker, a little bit more smarter, so that we can obviously let's not have those things happen again in the future.
Yeah, we've got some questions coming up about the windows and signing of players, etc. later, that sort of touch on that later on. I've got a question from one of our season ticket holders in the East End, Gary Watt, and he said, recently we've performed really well against the top expansive sides, the likes of Pompey, Bolton, Barnsley, Oxford. Yet we struggled perhaps a little bit against the likes of Burton, Bristol Rovers and Port Vale. Do you think that the successful formation and tactics that you adopted at Stevenage show a possible way forward against the anti-football teams who simply park the bus and play in that more percentage fashion?
Yeah, I wouldn't put Stevenage in the same way that Burton, that Bristol Rovers and Port Vale played, because Stevenage come and had a real go at us, so therefore the space isn't behind and the gaps in between lines are a lot bigger. I think sometimes when you play against teams that sit really, really deep, close the wide spaces up, I think that your control as a coach, as a manager, is taken away a little bit, and then the onus is on players to feel, to sense spaces and to react quicker, and then to produce moments of skill to change the dynamic of their shape. But it's more difficult to break a team down that has 10 men behind the ball. Man City will play week in, week out against teams that come and sit really, really deep. If you go and attack Man City and leave big spaces, they'll beat you 6-7-0 because they're so good. But in any game, when you play against an organised defence, an organised midfield, and people sitting, then it's just more difficult. So I think your tactical stuff has to come from individual quality and individual talent to make something happen.
Interesting. We've got a question here. He sent in quite a few, a guy called Gerard Shaw, and it is about Daryl McMahon when he was introduced as a set piece coach. There are quite a few here, so I'll try and read it as best as I can. But he was basically curious to know, when was his first week in the job and like first game he was with the team on the sidelines for a match, and was a set piece coach something you were after and like looking to add as an addition to the bench, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think in terms of Darrell coming in, I think he was after five, six games off the top of my head. Darrell was someone that obviously the manager of Dagenham, and then lost his job. He used to come into the training ground regularly to watch training. A good person, good football guy. He's obviously very, very local. So what the initial idea was, to bring Darrell in, and when we travel away to away games, we've always got five or six players left on the Friday and the Saturday. So Darrell will come in, give him a good training session. Obviously, he's a manager of a lot of experience, so he's got good sessions and he's got good knowledge. And then we spoke about a set piece coach, someone with a different voice that the players would listen to, and his whole week would be just set up to make sure that offensively and defensively we're good at set plays. And that was the thinking behind it, really. But first and foremost, he was a top guy that we enjoyed the company of, and thought that he could help with taking us forward. But we was also aware that Darrell wanted to be a manager, and he wanted to be a first team manager. So as soon as something would pop up that would take his interest, then we knew that it would be interesting to take a first team manager's job.
Thank you. Nice.
Thank you for putting that one to bed, I think.
Yeah.
Another question from Gerard Shaw. As I say, these are questions that are coming rather than from us. He's asked whether there'll be any changes made to the pre-season. He said that we played on bad pitches and we picked up injuries, and that's happened for two seasons in a row now. Whether there might be any changes made to the teams that we play, the ones that are not trying to kick us off the park, so that we don't get any injuries going into the season itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really tough. We're trying to get... pre-season is not just spoken about a week or two before we come back. We've completed pre-season now for the forthcoming pre-season, so we're only looking for one game, and it's the first Tuesday in July. It's really, really difficult to get a first team draft pick that is ready, that is prepared to play away from home, because we do like going to local non-league grounds, one, to help them out, but also to get our fans out and watch a game locally. But it's really difficult to find good pitches. The one what really shocked me last year was Colchester away on the last pre-season game, where we turned up and we had no indication of how bad the pitch was, and I was astounded where at one point I was thinking about taking the players off because it was that bad. And I think Colchester have had four or five games called off this season, so that was disappointing. I do think that a lot of injuries are just slight injuries in pre-season. We obviously had the Dan Aggie one where it was a broken bone, but that was nothing to do with the pitch. You're always going to pick up niggles in pre-season because the players have been resting or working at 30-40% of the body, and then all of a sudden has to work really, really hard. So you're always going to pick up little niggles. And we think that we've got the pre-season right this year. But the first pre-season game, whether it be Haringey, whether it be somewhere, is always really, really difficult. We don't want to play an AstroTurf, but then we have to find a grass pitch that is fit for purpose, and that is really, really difficult.
Interesting. The final one sent in from Gerard Shaw. In January you mentioned you'd asked Nigel for a change in the recruitment process. He's wondering if you could elaborate on that, and whether there's a plan in place for the summer window to recruit in the key positions that we may need to replace.
Yeah, the recruitment is a yearly long process. You're always watching players. People are always going out and watching games. We're always getting reports on different players. I don't want to go too much into the detail of the meeting that we had, but what we do need to do is we have a certain budget. We're never going to have a budget of a Bolton, a Portsmouth, a Derby. We're never going to happen. So what we need to do is every single penny of our budget, maximising it. And if we can do that, then it gives us a better chance.
Nice.
Okay.
Go on, Grant.
Yeah, so we're going on to questions from our message board now. The first one is, have you had a new contract under your nose, Richie?
Hello.
Have you got that?
Yeah, we've got you now.
Hello?
Alright, did you hear the question?
Sorry, no, I didn't know. Yeah.
Okay. I'm asking whether you've been offered a new contract at all, whether there's been one put under your nose.
Yeah, we spoke a lot in the last probably month or so. I'm hoping that in the next two, 3 days something can get sorted either way. I do think it's better for everybody that we have a clear indication of what is going to happen in going into pre-season. I think it's important that players that we're going to offer new contracts to, new players that we're potentially going to sign, obviously knowing that our manager will be there long term. So I'm hoping in the next 2 or 3 days something can be concluded.
Fantastic.
Lovely. That sounds like positive news to me. So this is another message board question. Have you been promised a budget to get us out of League One next year if we don't make it this year?
What's a budget that promises you to get out of League One?
That is, yeah.
There's no budget. For me, the money that Charlton has spent this year, whether it be on transfer fees, whether it be on wages, bringing in player after player after player, and up until 5 games ago, there was a massive threat of relegation for Charlton. So just spending a load of money doesn't guarantee your success. We are never going to have a good... Derby get 30,000, Bolton get 20,000, Portsmouth get 20,000 every single week. So we're never ever going to have their budget. Like I said a minute ago, we need to make sure that our budget works for us in the best way possible. So for me, you know, it's a really difficult question. What is a budget that can get Leonorian out of League One? It's not going to be the same as the guys like your Barnes and that. It's not going to be that. But can it be competitive enough to, if we, you know, we're probably 10 points shy of what I would want us to be. So next year with the same squad, could we make 10 points up if we didn't have the injury and some of the bad luck that we had at the start of this season? I think we can. I think we could. So I think the biggest thing is let's get a budget, let's get it sorted, let's get things in place and make that budget work best for us.
Grant, you happy to answer the next one?
No, you can go on.
Cool.
I
don't know if it's too bad. It's just with all the big first team injuries this season, are we doing anything wrong in the medical department or somewhere? And that was sent in by Fish.
No, I mean, the injuries. So Theo, absolute freak injury, terrible knee injury. You tend to find that the ones that are really, really bad injuries, no one's near him. But Jordan Graham does his knee, no one's near him. Theo, no one's near him. Danagi in pre-season, he just breaks a bone, no one's near him, he just lands funny. So our medical team are very, very good. They always get the players back quicker than anticipated. Some of the injuries are just freak. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just bad luck. We've had a couple of muscle injuries. I do think that some of the injuries to like Max Sanders is just him getting used to the way that we play. He was used to playing for Lincoln last year, that just sit back, low block, very passive, and now we're asking to compete and win duels and run. Danagi's hamstring was my fault because we played Reading away and we was going for the win. I thought we could win the game with Danagi on the pitch with about 6 or 7 minutes to go. I'm looking at him and I can see he's fatigued, but I have nothing on the bench. So if everybody was fit and my squad is big, I bring Danagi off and I put a ready-made replacement on and we can go for the win. End up keeping him on, and then in the 93rd minute he does his hamstring, so that one was on me.
Fair enough. I mean, your answer's kind of tying to this next question sent in by a message board member just asking, like, would you put the injuries down to the style of play, like the high press, or has it just been bad luck? But I think you kind of answered that question in your answer just there.
Yeah, the majority of bad luck, I never forget an interview Jurgen Klopp had when he took over Liverpool and he had his first pre-season, and the sports scientists, all the medical team are saying, Jurgen, you can't do this, you can't do that, they're going to break down. And he went, good, because they need to break down to be able to play for me in the way that I want them to play. And I think I take off a similar feeling of if you train players to play that you want to play, sometimes they're going to break down and you have to go through that. And I think Max Sanders is probably the one that has suffered most this year. You look at the likes of El Mazzuni, Brown, Prattler, who have played for us now for a couple of years, they're very, very robust, used to it, and can play week in, week out. So that's what we need to do. Sometimes you need the players to break down and go through that physical demand for them to take them to the next level.
Interesting. Nice. Grant, are you okay to ask the next one?
Yes. How important to a squad is it to have experienced players like Darren Pratley and Omar Beckles around? And apart from their on-pitch contributions, what else do they offer?
Standards in and around training. You know, Darren Pratley played hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games at every single level from the League Two to the Premier League. So he's a fantastic example. At 39 years old, if he's not training properly, why? If he's training properly every single day, why didn't you? I never find Darren Pratley. You know, we have a fine system in place where when I first took over the club, people were leaving jackets out, gloves out, hats out, and the training ground would be scattered with 10, 12 pieces of training gear, and it was a £5 each item per clothing. I straight away cancelled that and put up to £20 because, you know, if you were getting undressed in your living room, you wouldn't leave all your stuff in your living room. So treat the training ground like it's your own home. I never ever find Darren Pratt because he's too professional. So again, him and Beck, and there's a couple of others to be fair. Adam Thompson is very good. They just set standards and that spread through the group.
That's great to hear.
We had Darren Pratley for an interview the other week on the show, and I've taken one thing he said about ice baths. He goes home and he has an ice bath every day, and me being someone of more senior years, I've started to do the same thing, and I've noticed that actually it does make a difference. But again, it's all about standards and going through sometimes things that you go home and you want to forget about training, etc., but you have to do that extra sometimes to get yourself ready for the next day. Please pass on my thanks to Darren for that recommendation.
I believe we've got about 10 minutes left, so try and rattle through these ones. There's a couple here I'll ask quickly. So this was sent in by Buffalo Bill from the message board, and he's just asking, do you see League One being harder next season than this season?
Yeah, a lot stronger. Charlton will be as bad, Reading will be as bad, Wigan will be stronger. The club's coming down, obviously Rotherham are going to get relegated. They're always very, very strong in League One. The clubs coming up, Mansfield, Stockport, Wrexham, all have real, real big budgets, so I expect it to be strong here.
Cool. And which squad players do you feel have developed the most this season?
So might
have been squad players last season and have kind of integrated more in the first team this season.
Well, Jordan Brown played a lot of games this year, a lot more games. So he's been exceptional. I think every player has improved throughout the year. Ruel Tatero's goal returned very good. Shaq Ford has been a revelation for someone so young. Galbraith has improved as the season's gone on. I think Tom James has been absolutely outstanding all season, very, very consistent. Omar Beckles since November, December has been outstanding. Dan Hart before that was outstanding. So I think there's been a lot of players that can take a lot of credit this year, and we expect them to improve even more with one year league experience under the belt. We expect
him
to improve even more next year.
I agree.
I'd like to ask one question, please. It's funny, actually it's in my list to ask, and as a referee myself, it's not quite how I put this question, but I'll do it because it's come from someone from the outside. Yeah. Players get things wrong, managers get things wrong, chairmen get things wrong, and we will make mistakes. So why do football managers expect referees to be above all this? Referees are human too, and without them there will be no football. That isn't coming from me directly, but actually it's in some ways what I would say as well.
It's a good question. The answer being is the Referees Association below the Premier League, below the Championship, is not professional. So when I make mistakes, I use my weekend, all weekend, to reflect, to review, to then get in Monday to share the information with the players, to let them know what they've done wrong, why it went wrong, how we can impact in the future, and how we can get better. The referees at our level don't do.
Well, to some extent, they do, actually.
They have the Sunday off, and Monday,
to some extent, the referees do. They have a cup. They do go through their game footage at that level, and they do.
It's not professional level. It's not every single day. So it's your only job, and I think at League One, League Two level, with the EFL, the Premier League, should give referees a wage where they don't have another job. We all make mistakes, and we get that. But for example, my sending off against Wickham early in the season,
the referees have just said, Rich, you're not going to get sent off for that. You get away with it. The lawyer that I had said, Rich, I've never seen an easier case. You'll get off with it. He didn't do anything. But then when he goes to the referee who puts his case across, the referee association side with the referee. So they always side with the referee. If my players are wrong, and I believe they're wrong, and then players still think they're right, then I will disagree with my player and say, no, you're wrong. This is what you've done wrong. But the referee to referee, or to referee's coach, they all agree with each other. You see him on the Sky Sports News at the moment, and he's VAR, and they say, oh, but the protest has been right. But the protest has not been right, because that goal has been given offside, when the actual VAR guy is saying, no, he's offside. Check complete. The language, what they use, is just say, we've looked, he's offside, it's not a goal. Don't say check complete, and the referee is going, oh, it's check complete, on or off, and it's mumble jumble. So they get VAR and they still make decisions wrong. For me, the process that they go through is so complicated. They make more decisions. Sorry, they keep on making more rules and more rules. They're talking about bringing a blue card in. They can't even get the yellow and the red card right at the moment. So I'm very, very in support of the referees. The job they have is very, very difficult. And make it more simple for them. The fourth official is concentrating how long the ball's been out of play, how long this is, and he's not actually watching the game and thinking, I can help him, the referee there, because I thought that was a foul, and in his microphone go, that was a foul, and help him out. So then instead of three pair of eyes, you've got four pair of eyes, and they just complicate the game. So we step out of our technical area and the fourth official is going, you're getting a yellow card. Help your mate out rather than watching us. If we take one foot out of the technical area, I think that's the biggest problem. They complicate. I think the standard of refereeing since Howard Webber's come in this year has probably been at an all time low, because again, we want to create something that doesn't need creating, and let's start the season off adding 14 minutes at 15 minutes at the end of the game. And then when we get to November, December, everybody's squad is threadbare, and you're just creating more and more problems for yourself.
I agree with your point about the paying the referees in League One and Two. The problem is that the salary needs to be so high because people have to give up their careers that way, and then when they can't referee anymore, they can't then go back to them, and that's part of the problem. I think this is why they actually choose to stay part time, Richie.
That's no excuse for the amount of money that the Premier League and the EFL have.
Exactly. I agree with you, but you'd have to pay them very well to take them out of the part time regime.
I totally agree, but if you want a better product, you know, I always use airlines as a great example. So on every aircraft, you have the black box, and if something goes wrong, that black box feeds back messages to the whole network, not just a certain airport, not a certain airline industry. Oh, we came about this problem, and this is how we solved it. So every single airport, every single airline in the world knows how to deal with that problem. And you wouldn't get an aeroplane if the pilot wasn't full time and he was just doing it on a weekend as a hobby. You wouldn't get on the airplane, would you? So why shouldn't we have a professional football club, which is the biggest game in our country?
That's a good analogy. That's a very good analogy. Thank you for your insight. It's been good to talk to you about that.
I believe the Zoom might cut off at any moment, so I do apologise. It's been fantastic to talk to you, Richie. Just quickly, looking forward to the coming season, in what areas of the field will you be looking to strengthen as a priority, and where do you think the greatest opportunity for improvement lies? And that was sent in by Red in the Face.
Yeah, I think we need a goal scoring midfield player next year. I think we need a striker that is consistently scoring goals for maybe getting 15 plus. I don't see Ruel as an out at nine. He can sit in there, he can play wide, he can play as a 10, but we need a striker that can consistently score for us. I do think that we need a midfield player that can get goals. I think once we get Phil Archibald back, Jordan Graham back, Dan Aggie, we have got the foundations of a decent squad there.
Right, well, that was it. And thank you very much, Richie, for taking the time for talking to us. And thanks to Tom Short for arranging the interview in the first place. As I say, apologies for the quality of the sound, but that's Zoom for you at times. I'm afraid you're at the mercy of the internet, etc. So a lot of interesting points raised there, Terry. You've made some notes. And what stood out for you?
Firstly, he makes a good point about squad depth. It's so important in football now, isn't it? No matter what level you play at, he hasn't had the opportunity to change much from the bench, especially recently with all the injuries. He makes a reference to the bigger or the teams with the bigger budgets who can change it. And so you see at every level, even you say, it's funny, when I look at a team sheet now, I'm looking at the bench as well, you know, because it impacts the game so much. You know, back in our day, go back to one and two subs, it wasn't an issue really. You just brought a sub on, maybe well, obviously you couldn't change it too much in case you got injuries or too early. Now, I think that he struggled to get his best 11 out a lot of the time. So he hasn't, hence he's had to keep them on the pitch longer than he probably would like. You pick up more injuries by playing longer and longer and longer. It catches up with you at the end of the season. And you can see now we've got a few injuries. But it was a good point he made about that. You know, please God, next season we might have a slightly deeper squad that doesn't get injured as often. And there was a reference to injuries there, playing on certain pitches pre-season. Listen, it's very random. You get injuries at every club. You know, it's just part and parcel of the game. Sometimes you get luckier in seasons than others, but there's no way around it. You can play on a perfectly good pitch now and jar your foot in. You know, I think pitches are too good now because I don't think there's much given them, is there? You know, they're trying to contort their bodies into positions that are not natural on a pitch that's got no giving. Well, if your foot jars in or your foot gets wedged in, that you pick up a lot of injuries.
Yeah, Gareth, what were your views of the interview?
No, I'd carry on that point largely. I think the problem we've had all season is that we've never had the first choice 11 available. So what Richie was saying about perhaps being criticised for not knowing his best 11, which may or may not have been directed towards people who sit in the studio, myself included, I think. But at the same time, it's like we've never been able to, I think the biggest loss was probably Ajay. I mean, we only had that brief glimpse of what the lad's capable of, didn't we? But it was very, very impressive. And I think losing him early in pre-season, wasn't it? And then, you know, wasn't back until sort of late November. I think that really sort of derailed us. And it means all through the season we've had to try and move people into places to try and cover spaces and try and get something out of the team. And as Terry's just been saying, I mean, we don't have many options to change things from the bench currently, but I don't think we have many options as a first choice 11. I mean, if we're going to play a striker, I mean, we've talked a lot over the weeks about Piggott, haven't we? But picking a central striker now does really only rule Sotiriou, isn't there? That's all we can do at the moment. We've got, as Richie said after the Stevenage game, we had no fit wingers at all, you know, when Ollie O'Neill was out. So, that you know, that's the problem. And I think that's probably where we've gone. I think it's been a positive and a developmental season, but at the same time, I think probably Richie will be a bit frustrated that, you know, we didn't have all the tools that he perhaps wanted to use the way he wanted to play the game right from the off of the season. So.
I think the truth is, though, Joe, if you're going to get promoted, you do need that little bit of luck. I mean, obviously he wants a couple of new players in, but if he can get those players fit and not have the injuries, that's where your luck comes in, isn't it? You need that run of, you know, your best team being out there, no injuries, and they're the sides that normally end up going up.
Absolutely. You can be the best team in the division, but you need luck, and injuries is one of the things that comes into it. You know, you need to play teams at the right time. I always say that look at us, and we've got to play Lincoln. When we played them a couple of months ago, I didn't think they were anything special at all.
Well, that was the game that was tragically abandoned, wasn't it? And we were playing them off the park.
So that's another thing in a season you have to look at: injuries, times that you play teams in form or out of form, so to speak. Making points what Richie was saying. So he's kind of looking at next season, things about next season. He mentioned Theo there, didn't he? So it would appear that the club will be offering him some sort of contract, which is good because he deserves, you know, so it'd be very, I think it'd be very unfair, like with him with the injury he's got, just to sort of cast him aside. But he's earned a shot. For another season at least.
Just in my ignorance, are you allowed to get rid of an injured player on contract?
Yeah, contract. Why not?
Yeah. Okay, that's just a question. I didn't know, you know. Obviously,
it's very harsh to do it, isn't it? But I think, you know, particularly for somebody like Theo Archibald, who's actually been a very good servant to the club over the time that he's been here, hasn't he?
We haven't got Ming the Merciless in charge of the club, have we? So they're probably quite benevolent side of things.
So just, he's talking, you know, in dispatches about Theo, so that's a good thing that it would appear that he's in Richie's plans for next season. Talk about a new centre forward. Now that begs the question with regard to Dan Ajay. Obviously, he's going to figure if he's fit, but mm-hmm. he maybe sees him as a wide player, come off the wide. Mm-hmm. So if he's thinking about him coming off the wide, he's got Jordan Graham, he's got Ollie O'Neill, he's got Theo. It's interesting to see, you know, what his thought process will be. A lovely headache to have if they're all fit. You know, and the thing is, we know Dan can play centre-forward, but it'd be interesting to see if we do sign a centre-forward where what he would consider as his first-choice striking and forward line would be. But it would be a very strong one with very strong backup. And back to what you say, squad strength for next season, which, you know, is an important thing.
I wonder if that's informed by the Piggott situation. And I think the hint I took out the interview, and it's also something that came out the Q&A, is I think we were in for Kelman in January and it didn't work out. And I think that's where Richie got a bit frustrated.
Yeah.
And you'd argue that Kelman is probably not first choice over somebody like Adjei, but at this point of the season where Adjei's hardly played, yeah, then he would be a good option to bring
in. He's a decent backup to have, you know. He did say, though, that the person, the centre-forward, was someone that hasn't been involved with the club. He did say that, so... You know,
new
that
face.
Is, we don't know.
Yep.
You know, that's maybe a mystery that will be resolved in the summer if they go back for him. And then we're talking about, Richie was talking about getting a goal scoring midfielder in. And I said to Gareth off air, I said that the thing about a goal scoring midfielder, we've talked about this for a long time on this show. We haven't really had some. I think sometimes the way that we set our team up doesn't lend itself to having a goal-scoring midfielder because we play in a way where we retain possession in midfield. We don't get a ball into the box early very often. We do at times, and I think we look good when we do that, when we get that ball in early. Now, for a goal-scoring midfielder, you know, and we always come back to like the Steve Castle position, you know. Steve would get himself into the box because he knew the ball was going to come in there. If you've got no confidence in the ball coming in, you're not going to go in there, you know. And I think from that, and the thing is, we've got the tools to do that. We just talked about them wingers that we've possibly got for next season. And they're all good players, and they're all capable of delivering a good ball into the box. So it'll be interesting to see if we do. And I look at Jordan Brown, and I look at Ethan Galbraith. They are very talented boys, and they're more than capable. And I think you saw a little bit, Jordan, when he came into the got forward, I think he scored a couple of goals getting into the box. The other thing as well, you know, for a goal scoring midfielder is they've got to shoot more. I don't think we shoot enough at times. You know, you see the likes of Tom James, who's very, you know, two great feet, scored goals from outside the box. I'd just like to see us have a pop a little bit more often. I think sometimes we take an easy option, you know, keep, and I understand we want to retain the ball. I know Richie wants to retain, and I get that. I get all that.
Don't be afraid to miss.
No, exactly, you know, and I think there are times when, come on, have a go.
Or force a save, isn't it? Yeah. And then, you know,
you never know.
You know.
So I think if we are, you know, if he's looking for a goal scoring midfielder, I personally think he's got potentially two goal scoring midfielders there already in those two players. You know, I'm hoping next season that Galbraith will play midfield, which is his best position. You know, next season, I'd like to see the emergence of him as a goal-scoring midfielder.
Yeah, I mean, time's getting on here, and we're running out of time. So I'm just going to tell people that if you're waiting for Roper's Rant, we're going to issue that as an extra online, so you can listen to that later. It will be issued later this evening. Sorry about that, but we've got lots to talk about. And the point we all were very interested in was the refereeing point, Terry, and I know you've got your own feelings on that.
Yo, listen, I think we all accept that refereeing is a really hard job. It isn't helped by players because they cheat a lot, and let's be honest, it's cheating, you know. We saw the other week, Kai Havertz dives, blatant dive for me, gets away with it, stays on the pitch, scores a winning goal, and then we get told, oh yeah, we should have sent him off. So let's help the referees a bit more. And they actually showed the angle. The ref couldn't see from the angle he was at. Linesman maybe could have helped him out, but surely they've got to change the law on retrospective yellow cards, you know, and actually be, or not retrospective, but actually from the VAR perspective, can call the referee's attention to it next season. It's something I hope to bring in. But I mean, as I say, we've all, I think it works always. I think that the managers, the players have got to respect the ref. I think that the refs have got to be a bit more sort of transparent and hold their hands up a little bit more. It all seems very close shop a lot of the time. There doesn't seem to be much of a punishment there. If you're playing badly, you get dropped from a team. And I know they do drop referees maybe for one Saturday, but I just think there are times when the refs really don't help themselves either. And I think within the lawmakers can help the refs a lot more.
Do you think making them full-time, as they say, rather than part-time at our level, that would make a difference? But they, as Grant was saying, they've got to compensate them financially properly. Because if you've got a job, and let's just pick a figure and say you're on £45,000, £50,000 a year on your normal job, and they're going to pay you whatever they pay you the part-time, you know, you can't, if they're going to only offer you, you know, £60,000 or something, you think, well, I've lost my main job. And this is why sometimes part-time players in non-league, as you know, when you ended up your career in non-league, Terry, a lot of them were quite good players, but they couldn't run the risk of losing their main job because the fees being offered by third and fourth division clubs didn't match what they're on with their part-time wages and their full-time job. So what do we do with the refs? How much do we pay them?
I mean, it would seem a solution, wouldn't it? If we pay them more and make them full-time professional and make them more accountable, then they will get better. That seems like a fairly decent conclusion or theory to put forward, isn't it?
But it also would encourage, I think, if the wages was right, the ex-players, certainly the League 1, 2 and Conference standard players, to take up refereeing, I would have thought, Tel.
Poacher term gamekeeper, eh?
Richie's going to do it, according to his interview.
Going back to the original point, yes, they do need to pay them more money. Look at the money that's in football now. You can't.
They can't agree a deal for the lower leagues.
I know. You know, and therein lies the problem. There's too much money top heavy. You know, the money needs to filter down into the lower club, and also the money needs to filter down for referees at a lower level as well. And you're right, that would encourage more, it would improve standards. Will it happen? Probably not.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a reflection of life in general, isn't it? And how the country runs in general, isn't it? That the money stays at the top and doesn't really trickle down very much.
Absolutely.
I think that's just a reflection of life.
Right on, brother.
Yeah, well, don't say really. I'm no shot steward, mate.
Billy Herring will be very
proud. He'll be very proud of me, Billy, with that sort of statement, yeah. There's no red herring here, though. We've got to be careful. We're in Perda. We can't discuss politics on the radio, I'm afraid. But yeah, I mean, fair point. But we've run out of time, and it's been a great evening. Thank you very much, guys. I hope you enjoyed the interview, despite the interference on the signal there. Thanks, Gareth, for coming in. Thanks once again for your words of wisdom, Terry.
Yep, you're welcome.
And we'll see you all next week here, 7 p.m. on Phoenix 98 FM. Have a great week, everybody. Happy 90th birthday to Lottie. I must say that as well, Lottie Gatwood.
Returns, Lottie.
And hope you had a great day, Lottie. We'll see you all next week, everybody. Take care. Bye bye. This is our club, we are proud. So sing it up and sing aloud. We were formed in 1881. The claps in Orient had so begun. The old story on it runs. We're late and Orient from E10. Whatever challenges come our way, the Orient faithful are here to stay. Saturday comes again.